I think I'm good, so give me a countdown and whatever.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's time to start our course, and this is Hunt Tooley talking to you about World War One, and we have our presentation up, ready to go. It's a Mises Academy course, and you know where we are in the series. We will tackle this monster of a war in 8 sessions, and we've done the introduction. We've talked about the Battle of the Frontiers, that early stage of the war, the Schlieffen Plan, et cetera. We talked about the creation of stalemate last week, and we began to move more into what you might call a connection of the home front to the battle front, and this week we're this week we work on, we're on the 3rd session, and we will connect more the battle front and the home front from 1914 to 1916, the Storm of Steel. So that will be our topic for tonight. So welcome, everybody, and it's good to see everybody here. Let me make sure I have my chat windows and question windows open. I hope everybody can hear me. The sound is okay, and if so, I'll proceed. I'll check periodically to make sure everything's okay on these lists. Okay, well, where we ended up last week was with the stalemate, and you recall the first and most deadly part of the war per capita or per minute was the time when people weren't in the trenches, being protected a little bit by those trenches. So that's the generation of these fronts. Now the Western Front turns out to be the sort of stereotypical front, but all of these fronts in the end turned out to conform, at least in segments, to the Western Front situation. On the Western Front itself in November 1914, there was stalemate, and if you look at this map here, if you, I'll get my little white arrow out there, and you see the Western Front goes from the Channel Coast, just at Newport, and makes this kind of shallow S all the way to Switzerland. I mentioned that last week. At the turn of the line here is Verdun, this fortified city which anchored the Western Front from the French side, and therefore the German attacks there were this attempt to break through there. And then on the other end, Ypres is a very important stabilizer of the line. The Germans lap over it, as we saw last week on either side. And then the Somme River is in this region, and that's going to be an important part of the war. And then, of course, as the front goes through these big rolling wheat-covered hills of the Champagne and by Reims and so forth, all the way south. So that's the stalemate we're generally thinking of. And so for the next few minutes, I'd like for all of us to think about the nature of stalemate. And I don't just mean in a military way, but I certainly do mean in a military way. This is an early photo from the war. The Germans still have those Pickelhauben on, and those are leather covered with some canvas. They don't protect you from much. But here's a machine gun team at it with some observers on the side. And if you kind of get a sense of what's happening here, this is the trench warfare. This is what the Germans call a Stellungskrieg, a war of positions. And the Germans had, of course, retreated the last few miles back to prepared positions behind, so that on the Western Front, if we just take a quick look back at this on the Western Front from nearly all the way where there could be higher ground, the Germans had it, just simply because that's what they've been planning. They've been fighting out forward and in the rear areas, then building their positions. and anchoring that down, always on hills. It is amazing if you walk along the Western Front today, if you went from one end to the other, if you go visit Vimy Ridge or St. Julian's or any of the Somme battlefields. If you're in a German position, you're almost always looking down on the English or the French or whoever it was. So that's the nature of the Western Front. It was almost like the Germans were in a fortress behind that S, and the British and French had to attack. And of course, the Germans had made their point. They were on French soil. So it almost put the offensive necessarily into the ball court of the French and British, because the Germans had sort of made their play already. We're here in France. What are you going to do? Well, this machine gun team is, I know it's small, but if you can take a look beyond that, you see the barbed wire entanglements. These are not so much entanglements as little fences of, they would nail in or screw in, as with a dog leash post, screw into the ground those posts, and then string up barbed wire as a protective thing out in front of the trench. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But from this trench or from this post, you see these Germans looking out. They have some protection behind that machine gun. They're sighting the machine gun from the side to get enfilade fire, and they just cover the front that way. So one thing that this demonstrates is the power of the defensive. Now, a lot of military historians have talked about the power of the defensive, and they place it at somewhere in the late 19th century. Once you begin to get rifled shells from the weapons of the soldiers and rifled ammunition, rifled balls, once you get the rifles that you don't have to load standing up, once you get the improvements in artillery, once you get all these things going, then what military people sometimes understood, sometimes didn't, was that in a modern, full-fledged, regular, conventional warfare, the modern, a la 1910, 1920, then the defensive really had the advantage. And maybe it had the advantage as far back as the Franco-Prussian War or the American Civil War. But in any case, that's the key to this. Now, offensive-minded generals would argue against this and say, well, you're just talking about one kind of advantage. But it is true that the defensive became much more costly to break up. In other words, an offensive had become by this time much more costly. And this photograph of the German machine gun team, that shows you one reason why. Because all the defense has to do is cover that air with interlocking streams like hoses, garden hoses going back and forth, interlocking streams of machine gun fire, and it makes it very, very difficult for anybody to get within 1,000 yards of those or 100 yards or those positions, depending on how broad no man's land is. Here's the trench system as an ideal, and this is a drawing from from wartime, and it kind of gives a very neat sense of what's going on here. My arrow here is pointing toward no man's land, and in some kind of ideal trench world, they would throw a little bit of dirt back here for the behind the trench, and that's called the parados. And they had these neat footsteps, really cool. Elbow rest up here for men to be on this fire step, as it was called, and twice a day stand up on these things ready for the enemy. This whole thing is the parapet. They throw some dirt up there. This dotted line is ground level. And then here's a ditch built out in front of the trench. To tell you the truth, in all the thousands of pictures I've seen in all the trenches that I've been in the remains of, I've never seen anything like that. So it was somebody's good idea, but I'm not sure that ever happened. Here's a trench in practice. I mean, if that's the trench in the ideal, here's a trench in practice. Debris, animal parts, sandbags thrown around, holes dug in the side for extra shelter, and And I don't see any fire step there, and I don't see any elbow rest, nor anybody wants to put their elbows in the rest. And so there's a sort of trench in practice. Here's another one. Again, you know, what the fire step is underwater if it exists, and the elbow rest is, well, out of the question. So these are pictures of sort of the practical side of things. Now, the trench system is important to us. The whole environment of the system is important because partly out of this kind of physical setting came a lot of these changes at home, these terrible changes that we are aiming to talk about. We're looking here as we go up. We're looking out here into no man's land. If you can see the little label right there, on our side of that, the barbed wire entanglements. We've got some listening posts and maybe machine gun posts even trailing out in saps into no man's land. And then here's the front line with the good traverses of the trench. They're all crooked so that that shell blast would be minimized in case a shell fell in the trench or somebody threw a grenade, a bomb in the trench. Then there's a second line back here called a support trench. You see it there? And those support trenches, all have dugouts alongside. But that support trench is also traversed or crenellated, and again, to minimize shell blast. And actually, this system doesn't quite show all of it, because there is about here where that label, the nature of stalemate, is. There's another trench line. It's a couple hundred yards back, and that's called the reserve trench. So the trench network was really at least three trenches wide, and in most places more than that, because the trenches had either moved forward or moved backward. They had, in some cases, there were enemy trenches taken over and reversed. So it all depended on the situation. Communications trenches ran from the rear areas where people would walk above ground into these narrow trenches to walk to the front and then make their way along the trenches to the spot that they wanted to be on the front. And they had to have guides to get there. In other words, when a company went into the front line or a battalion went into the front line, there had to be a trench guide to guide those people forward. So that's our home. Our home country of the trench, and it's, again, that's an ideal of it. That's a little closer to reality, I think. You can see that reality here, and you can see the front line here kept up a lot better than the support line at this point. And then there's another line farther back over there. Everything pockmarked with shell holes and so forth. And if we could see, if we could see it more closely and with more definition, we could find the barbed wire there so that this no man's land out here would be definable. So that's actually kind of close to that that reality. Here's another sort of reality. I mean, here are trenches with the French in them, and that they've got some dogs in their trenches, don't they? Actually, there were quite a few animals in this war, especially dogs who were not only companions, but actually worked in some cases too. But these guys have a trench which is really not deep enough. The French trenches often were less complete, but again, that's tied to their idea of the attack. And so they didn't really want to make their trenches as homey as they thought the British were. But so there's a French trench. It's from a little bit later in the war than we're talking about today, probably 1916. I want to say something about the nature of stalemate here from a little bit broader perspective, a little bit broader standpoint. Once the stalemate happened on these fronts, then there was stalemate at home. In other words, the governments trying to fight this war found themselves in this war of positions where it was just side against side, and there was no going forward. We're going to look at a moment at all the military solutions attempted to break through that stalemate. But there had to be, everybody understood this, to achieve any kind of military breakthrough, there almost had to be some sort of breakthrough on the home front, in particular with regard to the state and the whole machinery of the state. So what we're looking at here is what might stand, for the moment, I think, is what might stand between the state and some kind of breakthrough in this war situation. We're going to see in just a few moments some details about the shell crises that cropped up in early 1915 that are a really important part of the dynamic of the war. And these shell crises showed up to their societies that you could win the war if you just made enough shells. But to make enough shells, you needed more wealth to do it. The state needed more wealth to do it. The state needed to pay for it some way. But there's this kind of block. For one thing, there's a block of civilization. A lot of these European countries, though they were all in some measure cruel and brutal when the war started, especially the Germans, in some cases, in some places, the Russians, not all the time with the Russians, but there were certainly cruelties and brutalities, the Ottomans at the beginning of the war. But there is certainly this restraint that we don't want to go all out. This is not necessarily war to the hilt. And so there were still some restraints of civilization in that sense that had to be got over in order to achieve some kind of breakthrough. There were also fiscal restraints that civilization had brought. In other words, the whole history of the West since, from the Middle Ages on and from before, was gauged at creating situations where there were opponents to the rising state, especially after this state appeared in its aggressive form in the 1500s. There were always opponents, and in many cases those opponents saw that their way to stand in front of the aggressions of the state was to limit it fiscally and financially. And so fiscal restraints also come into play here. So the governments involved had to get over the hurdle of fiscal restraints. Once the stalemate is in place, then also it's a war of attrition. And that means that both sides have only a certain amount of material, a certain amount of supplies, a certain amount of will, and a certain amount of human beings, a certain number of human beings that they can use to fight the war. And so you have this attritional aspect that's hard to be gotten over, but it's almost a spur, because every time one of the first two items here, the restraints of civilization or fiscal restraints, came up, then the attritional argument always kind of trumped these types of things. So that's part of the nature of our stalemate. One thing that historians, a word that it's almost a buzzword that historians now use to talk about what happened in these societies in the course of 1914-15 was mobilization. In other words, not just the military mobilization that we talked about last week on the fronts, but the mobilization of human beings, the mobilization of material, etc. And so what happened was that governments immediately saw they had to mobilize more troops, they had to get supplies into the hands of the soldiers, and so forth. And this was always difficult to do. Now, in the first days of the war, the recruiting of soldiers was pretty easy, and countries made it easier by offering sweet deals. The British had a particularly sweet kind of offer for young men from a given town. They could all join a Kitchener's battalion or a Powell's battalion. And in these Powell's battalions, they were promised that they could fight their way all the way through the war together with their pals from a hometown. Remember that designation, Powell's battalions, because we're going to talk about those pals next week. Another means of mobilization of the many various ones was the mobilization of labor, in particular bringing of women and other categories of who were not in the workforce into the workforce. This was done with advertising and paying low wages and appealing to people's sense of sacrifice and enthusiasm for the war, so that, as we'll see in a moment, many women flocked to the factories to make material for war, oftentimes artillery and munitions themselves. So there is this sense of enthusiasm that was abroad, and as we've seen, it sort of surcharged the atmosphere back in the early days of 1914, and the government's tried to keep this going. They realized, you know, I've assigned a song, it's a long way to Tipperary for everybody to listen to. But it is interesting that the songs from the beginning of the war were all either existing or they're just songs that people like John McCormick decided to record as a kind of public-spirited thing. And so soldiers took to the front these songs from Mother McCree and It's a Long Way to Tipperary and There's a Long, Long Trail of Winding and all of these songs, mostly the sentimental ones that spoke to soldiers of home and of their loved ones and so forth. But as soon as the stalemate hit, government set up songwriters in their various propaganda offices, which were soon to become propaganda ministries, or at least subsidized songwriters to write songs, sort of stock formula songs about the war with sloganeering and vilification of the enemy and vilification of the opposite leader. I have one American song in my library. It's an old piece of sheet music called We're Going to Hang the Kaiser Under the Linden Tree. And it's a very schlocky government job. I mean, it's obviously paid by the line, and many of the tunes in it there's a little bit of the Battle Hymn of the Republic and a little bit of this various patriotic songs. And so what the United States did, and earlier England and France had done, was to subsidize a kind of song propaganda. And those songs really didn't catch on for the most part, except a few of the very good ones. That's part of mobilization, too. So we have a lot of home front mobilization going on here as the stalemate sets in November of 1914. Okay, well, military breakthrough. Back to the tactical situation on the front, how do we break through? I mean, if the other guys are those Germans sitting up there with their machine guns, how do we do that? Well, there are a lot of ways to think about that. And everybody started thinking about that almost immediately. One possible idea was to get enough artillery pieces going, to get the guns in action, and to basically to incinerate the guys over on the other side, or stun them enough, or keep their heads down enough that we could make an attack that would take the first trench and then take their second trench and then take the third trench and then jump out and make it out to the green fields beyond and set the cavalry in motion and the charge of whatever brigade. And you see, that's the image of the military breakthrough. So we'll talk more about artillery in a minute, but of course that was uppermost on everybody's mind. But there were other methods too. There was an idea that you could undermine the enemy trenches, stuff them with 1,000 pounds of TNT, blow up the trenches, and then charge across while people were still interred in the rubble and stunned by the blast and wandering around and all that. And this photograph here is quite an amazing photograph of one such blast on the Somme. I believe this is a picture of the La Boisselle mine that went up in July 1916. But there are many places where these mines were used, and they were used it wasn't on the Somme first. Among the earliest mines was in the southern France at the southern part of the Western Front, close to Verdun, just to the west of Verdun, at a little village called, and you can see the labeling on this picture. It's very grainy, I'm sorry, but it's an old aerial photo and probably a French one. But In any case, the village is called Vauquois, V-A-U-Q-U-O-I-S. And the village was right there, in the kind of middle of this. If you can follow the arrow, this is there's a flat plain on one side. This is in the Argonne Forest. There's a flat plain over here. And this ridge or hill mounts up and goes up, 100 feet or so. It's that high, and I guess from the back side of the hill to this side is probably 700 or 800 feet, something like that. So the French had their trenches up here, their positions up here at the beginning of the war, and the Germans came right up on the hill with them. So the trench line was stretching across this picture and beyond, and so the Germans were there. And they were so close they could practically throw things at each other. In fact, I think they could throw things at each other easily. Somebody got the idea of digging under the other side and blowing up their trenches. And so they did that here and then here and then here and then here. And the other side blew back, and it was this furious mining sector. And what you are looking at here, and this is kind of hard to believe. I've visited Vauquois on several occasions. And you do have to see it, actually, to believe it. But this hill has a huge 100-foot ditch blown out of the center of it all the way across there from one end to the other. In other words, it is, in Wilfred Owen's words, it is groined out. It is really just dug out as if you took a huge scoop, 100 feet wide, and just scooped it all out. 100 feet down too. Even from this side to this side, you could almost throw a rock because it didn't separate from that much. But then the trenches just kept backing up. In other words, when this part blew, then they backed up to here and so forth and so on. I'll tell you another story about Vauquois before the end of the course, but that's I think a pretty spectacular picture. But you know, the essence of it is they blew these holes, and they blew this whole series of holes, but they didn't break through. There was no breakthrough. That line stayed exactly there, except for moving back beyond the blown out part for the duration of the war, until the American attack in the Argonne Forest in September 1918. Well, they got other tactical kinds of things to break through that they thought about. Poison gas, first introduced in March 1918 at Ypres. The Germans tried to take Ypres again. They wanted to break through also and end the war. So they tried at Ypres, and a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, a German. Helped engineer a kind of gas attack that was first used. But again, it was problematic, and it killed a lot of people, this gas that was released. And it killed a lot of Germans, too, but it didn't lead to any breakthrough. It led to a minor restructuring of that line. But everybody's wearing gas masks almost immediately, as you can see in this a picture of a machine gun team. Here the soldiers are actually attacking through a gas cloud of their own making, and so they run out of the gas cloud. That is quite a remarkable picture. And then that's, of course, flamethrowers at work. Flamethrowers were invented by the Germans also, and they were first invented down in the Vosges area where the Western Front ran through that rocky outcropping called the Vosges Mountains, V-O-S-G-E-S. And in the Vosges, the Germans were fighting straight up and down and against the French. And so it was a very ugly, rugged war, and that's where they first deployed flamethrowers. 1915. Another idea was what I'm going to call generally the strategic end run, and that was a lot of people had the idea, well, look, forget the stalemate on the Western Front. Keep the war positions there, strength against strength, and then we'll just go on a big end run around the enemy somewhere else in the world. In other words, they won't be expecting it. We'll attack at some point that will make some ally crumble, that will cause some supply line to end, that will end the war. One of the great creators of such end runs, indeed, one who did it over a period of two wars, was Winston Churchill, who was First Lord of the Admiralty at the beginning of World War I, and had thought of the blockade of the continent as a kind of end run. We'll talk about that. We've talked already a little bit about. We'll talk more. But one of his other big ideas was to attack the Ottoman Empire, and to attack close to the Dardanelles Strait. So in this map, I wanted to get a small map, but what we're looking at here is the tip of the Strait of Dardanelles. In other words, just the other side here, a few hundred yards, is the other side of the land. And then if you go up this way, you're going up into the Sea of Marmara and right up to Istanbul, which is on the Bosporus. And so so we're really at, an important part of the Ottoman Empire. And the British had already tried to force the Strait of Dardanelles, and they were turned back by the Turks. And so Churchill said, well, look, here's this peninsula. It's this high ridge over this peninsula. But what if we attack on this side? Then all we have to do is reach the top of these low mountains here, and then we can fire down into the Dardanelles and wipe out all the batteries of the Turks, and then make our way by sea and by land all the way up this peninsula to Istanbul. Could I add that today the drive from this area to Istanbul is about 2.5 hours, so it's rugged a lot of the way. Okay, this is the attack on Gallipoli, and it's Churchill's big idea. And so what he did was to man the attack with mostly non-English people. He signed up a couple of French divisions, and in particular he drew on the ANZACs, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, who had trained and gotten ready to fight with the British. The Australians, of course, and the Canadians and the South Africans, they all came into the war. That we talk about next week. But this attack was basically French, Australian, New Zealand, and partly English. And you can see the French landing here. Out in the bay, the flotilla with all the troops on it, all the beaches down there. This is at the tip end of the peninsula. The French area was here, where there really was a fairly broad beach. But farther up, this looks a little like Normandy in this picture, but farther up, the beach is a few feet wide, 50 to 60 to 70 feet wide. But then it starts this kind of stuff almost immediately. That's a famous painting. There's the Sphinx right there, and then there's a photograph of the Sphinx. It looks like the terrain looks a lot like an American canyon, like some parts of the Grand Canyon or something like that. And so the ANZACs and the French came and attacked. The attack began in April 1915. It was going to be the end run. They were going to take the Turks out of the war by taking Istanbul. And the war would be over even way before Christmas. What they didn't count on, however, was the standout defender, Mustafa Kemal, who was a colonel at the beginning of the show and ended up as a general. But Kemal was an active officer, a brilliant officer, who saw what was coming and manned these cliffs and gave his famous order very tough Australian and New Zealand troops attacked up these cliffs. The little white things you see there are actually the attackers going up the side of those cliffs. And this is when Mustafa Kemal gave his famous order to the troops, "I do not order you to attack, I order you to die." and in the time that we are dying, others will come to take our place and we will repel the British. Well, they didn't all die, and he didn't die. He went on to have quite an amazing military career and then an even more amazing political career. But what I'm saying is that the features on this beach are not the kind of features that you just take. The Turks entrenched at the top. The British made it a little way up the side, like to places like this and this, and in some cases to ridges like this, and in some cases even higher. But these are New Zealand troops in the heat of this terrible locale, very low, very hot, very ugly, and they're stuck in those trenches out of the wind too. So it turned out to be not a good idea for several reasons. One of the reasons was, again, the defenders and the Turkish army was fully prepared. You see an artillery piece here being served, and you might note that, you know, it doesn't have any elevation to it. Look, there's no tube coming out this way. That's because it's down. It's shooting down in almost a direct fire on the British troops below. Let me take a quick break and just check and see if we're doing okay. Some of these questions we will be dealing with very much later on, so I won't necessarily answer all of these right now. Before we end this, there will certainly be, when we see all the changes that took place in the war, there will certainly be indications that the Allies were preparing a new kind of war, that the Germans were preparing a new kind of war, and we'll be talking about that in the weeks to come. Did Leslie ask, did Churchill have any idea of the terrain? Well, I think he knew pretty well, but he also knew the terrain of the Balkans when he suggested in the Second War that was the soft underbelly of Europe. I think he was just a kind of unrealistic person. You know, when this war opened, Leslie and everybody else, Churchill, as the First Lord of the Admiralty, decided that he could save Belgium by getting up a troop of Royal Marines, and they rushed to Antwerp to protect Antwerp, the port of Antwerp, and set themselves in front of it. I mean, they were pretty soon overwhelmed and had to get out of Dodge, but he's that kind of excitable personality. These ideas occur to him, and he tries them, or has somebody else try them. So Rob says that he never committed quite enough resources. That may be, but there were a lot of troops there, and the British got close to the top. But to tell you the truth, even with more resources, I think the Turks had plenty of shells and plenty of people. It's a fairly close thing, but maybe so. I mean, that's certainly a discussion. Here's one of the final attacks. These New Zealanders are making their way up. They're now close to the top, but they just don't get there. Finally, in the at the end of the year, the British decide to call off the attack as a bad job, throwing good money after bad, and so Gallipoli is over. So there's no breakthrough there either. There is another kind of strategic end run that's carried out at the beginning of the war in Galicia, and this, I think, on the part of the Russians. In a sense, everybody wants to break through. Everybody's trying to break through. So let me say a little bit about this part. This is the southern part of the Eastern Front. Just behind us up here, if we looked up in this area, that's where the Germans were in charge, where Hindenburg and Ludendorff and many, many others, their friends, had defeated the first and second German Russian armies. And so what we see here are the third or fifth and then eighth and ninth German armies poised in this region, where another titanic war, again in Wilfred Owen's phrase, took place. The first arrows here. The red are the Austro-Hungarians, and of course, what's behind all these soldiers is Hungary. But of course, the Austro-Hungarian, the K&K, K und K army. That's the Kaiserliche und Königliche. That's the imperial and royal army. It was all mixed of different units from different places. So there were German speakers in here and Hungarian speakers and Slavic speakers, etc. But the army started out here, well to the north and east of the Carpathians, and hoped to make an attack to drive the Russians back out of being a threat to Austro-Hungarian Galicia. But once they attacked, there was this, the blue represents the counterattack, and that was an attack that began in September and continued on for the next month, until there was another stalemate installed right here into the Carpathians and in the foothills of the Carpathians, so that the Austro-Hungarians were basically pinned against the Carpathians, defending from a strong Russian line. One of the garrisons of the forts on the way, the garrison here at a place called Shemishwa, and I'll show you the spelling in just a second, but it's this fort that holds out, so it's totally surrounded, and the Russians besieged it, of course. It was surrounded, and they besieged Shemishwa there was a small broken period in November, October, November, but basically it's a continuous siege up until the March of 1915. March 22, after 133 days of siege, the garrison at Shemishwa surrendered. That's Shemishwa, I guess there's not a cross to the L. I think there is a cross to the L, but and if so, it's Shemishwa. Anyway, the 100,000 soldiers, Austro-Hungarian soldiers, surrendered there, and then that meant that the whole line was here, and we'll talk about what happens next in the next installment of our Eastern Front things, but. It's spectacular big battles, and the losses here, I've got a tabulation at the end of this in just a few minutes where we'll talk about losses for 1915, and the losses are colossal in this region. Those are the Cossacks, of course, entering Shemishwa. Okay, well, there's another way of grand strategic breakthrough, and apart from the military fronts, and you know, I haven't mentioned the other military ideas. In a way, you could talk about submarines, the German sub war as a means of a breakthrough that didn't quite break through. You could talk about a lot of aspects, but this was the mindset once the stalemate war froze up. And set in, then this was the mindset. But one important thought on all minds of all diplomats and all statesmen was that diplomatically you could get this war to change shape. Sometimes I've read diplomatic histories and diplomatic commentaries that suggest that diplomacy sometimes is not as important in wartime, but in World War I it was certainly even more important, even more intensive, because it was a life and death issue. Diplomacy had to do with getting countries that were uncommitted to be committed to us, to our side, whichever side. So we look around for countries that would be, there were the neutrals, there was Sweden, There was Spain, there was Switzerland, the Netherlands. You get the picture. There were neutrals who said they were going to be neutral and stuck to it. But there were also countries who started out not in the war, just not taking a side. And these were the countries to try to get in. And in many cases, both sides tried to get them in. So it turned into a kind of bidding war. Take, for example, the case of Italy. Italy had been, before the war, a member of the Triple Alliance, that is, the alliance with the Austrians and the Germans. But in the run-up to the war, through the second Moroccan crisis and the further crises, the Balkan crises, Italy became very unstable from the standpoint of the Austrians and Germans, and was able to just back off entirely once the war started and say, well, you know, really, we're not going to declare war. Well, what happened then, and I think what the Italians wanted to happen, was for both sides to say, well, look, what would it take to get you in the war on our side? We could offer you, let's say, this whole part of the Alps that you don't have. We could offer you this territory on the sea that you don't have. We could offer you this colony in Africa that's next to yours that you don't have. And so there was this kind of bidding process, and the Italians weighed their opportunities and decided, held out for a long time, decided to come in only in May 1915. The Ottomans had already come in. It was pretty apparent to everybody that the Ottoman Empire would either remain neutral or be on the German side. The Germans had, in recent decades, become very friendly with the Ottomans, had displaced the British as their main sort of European friend, and had retrained the army and so forth and so on. And so it was kind of apparent that the Ottomans wouldn't be on the Allied side. However, the Allies did try to keep the Ottoman Empire out of the war, and it didn't work. On October 28th, just a few weeks after the war started, the Ottoman Empire declared war and became a member of the Central Powers. The next, after Italy to come in, and this was again a kind of bidding situation, was Bulgaria, which came in on the side of the Central Powers, and this was a big decision for Bulgaria with its exposed position vis-a-vis Russia. But it also could shoulder along with the Ottoman Empire, and so Bulgaria came in return for some promises which didn't get fulfilled since Bulgaria's side lost. Portugal was brought into the war basically by the British in August 1916, and Portugal participated as a Western Front power, as a member of the war alliance. Romania came in on the Entente side in August 1916 also, and so the Entente gains. Then finally, of course, the huge diplomatic victory of all diplomatic victories was the April 1917 entry of the United States, and that one we'll talk about later. But I want to get this string of countries in your mind. In other words, we're trying to get the uncommitted ones in. Let me look at the questions for just a second. Did Belgium return to a state of neutrality after the German invasion, or did they join forces with the Entente? Belgium joined the Entente. Belgium was certainly in the Entente, but you realize that there were only a few feet of Belgium that were not occupied by the Germans. Just whatever was behind that little bitty bit of the line that the Belgian soldiers held. So, but they were regarded as one of the Entente powers. Yes. Okay. Here I want to talk about artillery as a way of breaking through, so to speak. And we're moving now toward the end of the end of the presentation. But I think this is a very important topic. There's a series of shell crises. They happen almost at the same time, these crises, with all the powers, and it has something to do with the sort of natural running out of resources after furious war. But let me start this narrative with the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, a little town in France close to La Bassée. This is all just south of Ypres, over the line in French Flanders. And March 10th, and 11th, 1915, to the First Army Commander, British Commander, General Douglas Haig, commanded an attack on the village of Neuve Chapelle. And I can use my little arrow here and show that the Indian Corps was lined up here, two Indian divisions, and then the 4th Corps was lined up here, two British divisions. They all attacked. There was a little bit of artillery hammering of the village, and then they attacked, and it was kind of a textbook attack, and they ended up in these trenches almost immediately, just a few minutes after the battle. It's all flat here. This is French Flanders, after all. And what happened was that they were all solidified, and they launched this assault across here. But far over here, just about, you know, where this line starts. Oh, no, Nathan, I'm not writing on the slides. I'm just pointing with my little arrow. I hope you can see the arrow. Can you see that? Can you see the arrow? Ah. You can't see the arrow. Okay. I thought you could see the arrow. Can you see it now? Okay. Wait. Back. Okay. Well, let me just point here then. They attacked, the attack was here. Hey, it even has my name on it. Look at that. They attacked the village. The British from up here, the Indians from up here. Sorry, everybody. I'm glad you mentioned that. Thank you. Okay. So I have to point. Then they came to these new lines right here. There's the village of Neuve Chapelle. And then they started attacking across this space out here. Okay? And what is pictured right here, right just in front of where that arrow is, in other words, right along here, that's called the Aubert Ridge, A-U-B-E-R-S, Aubert Ridge. And the Germans were lined up along this ridge. After the attack, they retreated to this ridge. And the British attack not only slowed, but really got hammered. Out in the area that's all along this, there were several problems. But and one of them was there was a ditch there that they didn't realize was there. It was hard to get over. But one way and the other, they lost their momentum, and that's the end of the arrows for now. And the next week, Sir John French, who was the commander of all British forces of the BEF. Was questioned by a journalist, and he said, well, we ran out of shells. We didn't have enough shells to do anything with, and if we'd had more shells, if people on the home front would just make more shells, we wouldn't have so many killed, because we had a lot of people killed because we didn't have any shells. You see this kind of thing. That may not have been why they didn't win, but it certainly is true that Haig fired off more shells in that particular battle than the British had fired off in the whole Boer War. So, I mean, it's a different kind of war. Well, anyway, this caused a big crisis at home. The British Liberal Prime Minister Asquith, Herbert Asquith, fell, and he returned, but now in a coalition with many stronger hotheads and a lot of people who were much more into not business as usual in Britain. A Ministry of Munitions was created to be headed by the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, David Lloyd George. They got everybody busy. The well-known British Jewish scientist Chaim Weizmann was put on the job of producing acetone for cordite, and he was able to synthesize that. There were new armaments plants, one of them put at Gretna, and many more. Women were recruited to the plants, started working there. They were called canary girls because the toluene and other chemicals they were working with and the TNT destroyed their livers, and they got jaundice from it. So the newspapers happily called them canary girls because they were all yellow. And shell production rose from 500,000 shells in the first 5 months of the war to 16.4 million in 1915, and it got bigger and bigger. So this is the way it goes. there's a shell crisis and then results from that. There was a shell crisis in Germany that produced the War Raw Materials Office and more shell production and so forth and so on. One of these new shell, one of these new munitions plants was sited at Dachau, just north of Munich. And that the land of that site was later recycled by the German government under Hitler, much later, into a well-known concentration camp. But it started out as the Royal Pulverfabrik, the powder factory. And here are some women in the interior of that plant working on some of the finer aspects of that of those shells. In France, the shell crisis led to big results, too. It was solved mostly by getting a lot of steel from the United States and some coal from Britain. But France suddenly changed the landscape by recruiting 450,000 women and released about 350,000 men from the army to go and work in munitions plants. The socialist Albert Thomas, organized shell production with the help of rising state intervention. He was a socialist anyway. He believed in the interventionary state, and so telling people what to do in terms of manufacturing shells and confiscating property and that type of thing were second nature to him. One of his assistants, Louis Loucheur, was a person who had been in an arms-producing family, so he knew all about producing armaments, and eventually took over from Thomas as the head of the munitions ministry, and he was a very, very convinced advocate of national efficiency. He was a Compiègne technocrat, or a Saint-Simonian technocrat, and wanted France to be run on that basis, and eventually he got his wish. So you have the shell crises, which end up in huge, big munitions plants everywhere. This this beautiful painting by Louis Guillard is almost a kind of a romanticizing of the of this picture. And again, it comes in 1916, and again, he was probably paid by the French government to do that. So there's all these shells produced, and you see the war is now from the capitals, the war is in the background, but all these shells have to be produced. So how do you pay for those? This is the big crisis of the first part of the first part of the war. Just as you would as you would probably expect. I mean, they didn't raise taxes. People would be very unhappy with that. Well, they were raising taxes slowly. But and they did borrow money, but essentially they prepared the ground to inflate. So look, it's July 31st. That's before August 4th, correct? That's before the war is going on. The Reichsbank, that's the central bank, has already discontinued the redemption of banknotes in gold. Okay, so from the from the moment it looks like the war is going to happen, we go. In that sense, off the gold standard. In Germany, the war credits bill. These are all these three moves are all on the German side. Just as an example, similar things happen in other countries. In the war credits bill passed by the Reichstag, the parliament, this confirmed the above, and it set up loan banks, which had no restrictions on them in terms of floating short-term bonds. There wasn't any committee permission to get. There wasn't any government permission to get. The Reichsbank could just tell the loan banks, called Darlehen Kassen, for those of you who want to know, those loan banks just loaned out money whenever the Reichsbank told them to do that. The war credits bill also authorized the Reichsbank to issue a huge variety of short-term bills and easy kinds of bonds and so forth, treasury bills and various other instruments. So there's now hugely increased flexibility for an expansion of credit, and then of course gold itself is no longer is being hoarded by the government. And of course the argument for discontinuing the redemption is that they didn't want citizens hoarding that gold and getting their gold, their hard-earned money out of the bank. So what does this mean? Well, this one calculation of one source, and it's an economist. I'm not sure it's completely correct, and I'm not sure that we couldn't spend years figuring out the expenditures of these governments in this period of time. But at least somebody's taken a crack at this, and they think that the government expenditures of Germany rose by a factor of 15 from 13 to 17, that Britain's government expenditures rose by a factor of 14, and France's by a factor of 6. That's for what it's worth. Russia also has its own shell crisis. It's almost like the whole war is a continual shell crisis for Russia. There are their industrial problems, transport problems, the bureaucracy's confused, the Duma okays unthinkable budget, and then proposes to finance it with a higher tariff in January 1915. There's the whole corruptive element of the Tsar's family situation vis-a-vis the Tsarevich and Rasputin, and I'm sure all of you know something about that. From August 1914 to January 1915, prices rose in Russia by 40%. It's the beginning of an inflation regime. The only thing that keeps Russia in the war, I think, is the rise of the so-called voluntary associations, which were organizations of people on the ground level in the zemstvos, or counties, and the municipalities of Russia. And outstanding individuals created an almost an almost spontaneous order where people who thought that things should be done, you know, proceeded to get those things done on the countryside. The voluntary associations, the zemstvo and municipality groups, and these groups organized for the war effort, kept Russia in the war, and then eventually turned against the Tsar and helped to bring down the Tsar in the parliament. That's a story for later on. The economics of total war is an issue that we're going to be talking about a whole lot, but let me just suggest here that even early in the war, there were governments and bureaucrats and thinkers who were redefining property. Walter Rathenau was from a business family. The family owned German General Electric, and he became a dollar-a-year man almost immediately the day after the war started to head the German economic preparation for war. Eventually, he was head of the War Materials Raw Materials Office. And at the end of the year, 1 year into the war, he wrote this. The term sequestration, which is basically confiscation, of course, the term sequestration was given a new interpretation, meaning in months past, a new interpretation, somewhat arbitrarily, I admit, but supported by certain passages in our martial law. Sequestration now does not mean that merchandise or material is seized by the state, but only that it is restricted, that it is, that it no longer can be disposed of by the owner at will, but must be reserved for a more important purpose. At first, many people found it difficult to adjust themselves to this new doctrine. Well, I wonder why. His assistant was a very important individual in 20th century history, little known, a person called Richard von Mullendorf, and he was Rathenau's assistant, and he was an energetic Taylorite, that efficiency theorist and social Darwinist from America. More about that whole group of people later, but this also comes from the shell crisis, etc. Well, for the record, from January to December 1915, if we count killed in action, missing in action, wounded, deathly sick, and these categories are, of course, a little hard to or to put your finger on, and also POWs. Then let's add them up. Western Front, 915,000. Eastern Front, and that's not just KIA. That I can use my that KIA should not be there. I got to take that out. But Serbian front, 219,000, Italian front, 443,000, Gallipoli, 503,000 casualties. This is all sides, of course, for each of these fronts. Mesopotamia, 36,000 casualties. On the Russian-Turkish front, 113,000 casualties. Probably about 7,000 more at sea and in Africa and some other remote theaters. And the total comes to 5,650,914 killed, missing in action, wounded, sick, POWs. It's quite a massive, massive loss of life. That's the year 1915, which I've mainly concentrated in our lecture tonight. At the end of this year, all armies introduced steel helmets. Strangely, at the same moment, this is from December 1915 to March 1916, there was this movement to introduce that famous weird British Brodie helmet or the tin hat, the German Stahlhelm, the French Adrian helmet, and they all made their appearance at the same time. Edmund Blunden, one of the great observers of the war, who was on the battlefront for most of the war, became a professor of literature afterwards, a fine poet, wrote in his memoir, "It is true that steel helmets now became the rule. Their ugly, useful discomfort supplanting our old friendly soft caps. The dethronement of the soft cap clearly symbolized the change that was coming over the war, the induration from a personal crusade into a vast machine of violence." And I think that's a very important thing to note. Other Western Front fighters also noticed the same thing. On the German side, for example, Ernst Jünger made a comment almost exact. But I want to end with two poems, one of which you've read and the other you've probably read too. But early in the war, the great patriotic Rupert Brooke, like a generation of people coming awake, signed up for the war, although he was really pretty old for it, and wrote this poem. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam, a body of England's breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by suns of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given, her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven. So this is the beginning of the war, and Brooke unfortunately did find himself lying in a corner of some foreign field before the next year was out. And then the poem that you read for this class, and it's a very different spirit. Blunden was younger, he was more cynical, he was in the war longer, he was on the Western Front. And here's the concert party poem. "The stage was set, the house was packed, the famous troop began. Our laughter thundered act by act, time light as sunbeams ran. Dance sprang and spun and neared and fled, jest chirped at gayest pitch, rhythm dazzled, action sped, most comically rich. With generals and lame privates both, such charms worked wonders, till the show was over, lagging, loth, we faced the sunset chill. And standing in the sandy way, with the cracked church peering past, we heard another matinee, we heard the maniac blast of barrage south by St. Eloy, and the red lights flaming there, called madness, come my bonny boy and dance to the latest air. To this new concert, white we stood, cold certainty held our breath, while men in tunnels below Larch Wood were kicking men to death." So here's a scene from 1915 and a scene from 1914, and I think you see the advancing attitude based on those two points. Okay. Well, that's it for the lecture, and I'll just run us back up to the opening, or I don't know, let's find a good picture to sit on. I like Beauvoir, but I like those, I like that. So, let's turn to some questions now. I see that there are already some going on. Sorry I couldn't get my arrow going, but sometime I'll get all the technical things working exactly right in this presentation. Okay, Carl Fielding asks a question. Why so many casualties in the East? And there are two or three answers that contribute to that question, Carl. For one thing, the armies were bigger. I mean, these were just, they're just bigger areas involved. The conditions were more primitive, and there were fewer shells per soldier, all right? What we're going to find out, and we're going to talk about this in next week and the week after that, is that shells came to, for the soldier, to represent a life-saving kind of thing, at least their own shells did, because as Pétain would say when he took over at Verdun, he said, look, soldiers, now we're not going to take trenches. We will just walk over and occupy those trenches. The artillery will take the trenches. What he meant was, we're going to incinerate the opposite trenches with so much fire and so much explosive and shrapnel that there just won't be anybody there to occupy the trench, and we'll just walk over and take it. So, and many, he was a soldier's general, Pétain, and I think that's what many soldiers felt like. They wanted to see the enemy pulverized so that they themselves wouldn't get killed. Well, in the East in this war, there weren't enough artillery shells, and so both armies, the Russians more than the Austro-Hungarians, and we know that from the casualty shares, because the Russians actually had much more of that total than the Austro-Hungarians. But what would happen is that the Russian commanders, not having enough shells, not even having enough rifles, would replace the shells and the rifles with Russian bodies, because they had plenty of those. Think of it, the Russians had the largest reserves of manpower to draw on. And so, and this is also a Russian military habit that goes pretty far back into history. I mean, we can talk about the use of Russian bodies to absorb the impact of Napoleon at Borodino, and we can talk about Russians in World War II attacking positions that just couldn't be taken, but just with wave after wave after wave of assault. So that's the kind of thing that was going on, and so I think that that explains a lot of it. And two, these were just huge areas to be fought over, and there was a lot of war going on there, more than we. I mean, we're really absorbed with the Western Front. I know that I am, but since that's the part that the Americans fought on, but that Eastern Front was, even in World War I, a real abattoir. Okay, have we more questions? Let's see. Maybe I'm missing the question line, but I don't see any more right now. Can everybody hear me? I feel a little bit alone. Ah, thank you, Louis. Louis Maynard asks, do you know of any warring nation that did not possess a central bank, and how did they finance their expenditures if they had no such banks? I don't know of any... of any warring nation that didn't have a central bank. There may be one, but there was a Russian central bank. I can't think of any. To tell you the truth, I don't know about Bulgaria and Romania, but and the Ottoman central banks there was an Ottoman bank. I don't think it exactly had the same power as a central bank, but that and a couple of other banks cooperated, if I'm remembering correctly, but it had something similar. So Yeah, I mean, they had to, they financed their expenditures, but of course, one of the ways they're financing, and you can look at, you know, how they could finance it. They could confiscate things from people, or they could win it by conquest, or they could raise taxes, or borrow money, or they could inflate. And they borrowed a lot of money, all countries, and we'll go into this in much more detail in the next classes, but all countries put out war bonds. They're called liberty bonds, war loan issues. These are all the same thing, to get people to buy into the war and be enthusiastic and, you know, buy liberty bonds and all that stuff. And so everybody did that. They borrowed money. But the most important way for subsequent history and probably for the war effort itself was the shift of property from the people to the government by means of inflation, both the expanding of the currency, the paper currency, and by the expanding of credit. So that's the interesting thing. You know, one point that Mises has made in a number of places was that in the First World War, one of the elements that kept these governments going, I mean, they used these horrible totalitarian, horrible interventionary processes, but one thing that they were doing was feeding off an open society, a free enterprise, corporations that had not been on the dole. They were feeding off this kind of capital built up by the great classical open Europe, and so they could keep going for quite a while. I mean, it's amazing the extent to which these the open market in Europe was able to survive this siphoning off of all its resources. Okay, John says, have you read John Mosier's book on the myth of the Great War? I haven't read that. I just haven't gotten around to reading it. I'm always skeptical of historical revisions, but I found his arguments compelling and logical. Since I have no basis to evaluate, I'd like the opinion of someone. I should read it. I just haven't done it. I don't remember exactly when that came out, but it was about the time I was putting mine out, and I just wanted to write mine and get it done, and I didn't read his, but I've heard people talk about it, but I can't give an opinion since I haven't read it. Philip Sargent, hello Philip, asks, the Gallipoli campaign, why did the Brits not simply force their way up the Dardanelles? Oh, I know the answer to that one. They tried that, Phil, just before the Gallipoli campaign. In fact, just after the war's end of the war, I can't remember the month now. It's the declaration of war came in October, and I guess it was in January that the British tried to force their way through the Straits. Turks did this. I've got to say, there's a wonderful book on the Turkish military in World War One, and they're fighting, actual fighting of the war, by Ed Erickson. It's called Attack and Die, or something like that. And it's about the Ottoman army and the Ottoman navy. And here's what happened. The British thought that they could just force the Turks, of all people, out of their positions. But the Dardanelles, or the Çanakkale Strait, is extremely narrow. I mean, you know, Byron swam it, and there's a famous poem about that, but anybody could swim. I mean, anybody who's a swimmer could swim across. It's not but a few hundred yards. And the Turks put out minefields. They had shore batteries. They had concealed batteries. They had direct fire batteries. They just kept pumping men in, and the British came in with their minesweepers, and little Turkish vessels from the Turkish Navy would sweep out right in front of them and undo their minesweeping, and it was quite an amazing battle. And today it's a national site. There are signs up everywhere at the little town of Çanakkale, on the straits, just inside the straits, just up about a mile from the very tip end. And those signs all say Turkish victory. I mean, it's a very proud moment in Turkish history. So the British actually couldn't force the straits. And the idea was if they could get a foothold and get to the top, that they could then work in tandem with the army and move up to Istanbul and open up this big new front. But they never got to the top. But that's a good question. But the answer is they tried. They couldn't do it. From Nathan Haste, how were the Turkish masses convinced to join the war? Was Islam involved in some way? Nathan, the Turks, and in fact, the Turks were one of the countries that had conscription going into the war. They had the Russians conscripted, Turks conscripted, Germans, Austrians. I'll think of more in a moment. It is true that when the Ottoman Sultan declared war, he declared a holy war. He declared jihad against the Entente powers. But I think that was merely for show. Turkey was already a place where Islam was a very important part of the scene of things. But and the Turkish religious establishment ran so many orphanages and homes for this invalids and all kinds of things that it was an important part. There was a figure in Turkey called the Sheikh el-Islam who was a very important influential person in the government. But on the other hand, it's also true that Islam was not a dominant element, and certainly it wasn't taken in any kind of fundamental sense by the vast majority of Turks. Now, throughout the empire, there were also Arabs, there were also Kurds, there were also all kinds of other people. But basically, the Turkish army was made up of people who were from Anatolia and who were, I don't mean in any way less serious, but they were not in any way, for the most part, fundamentalist about the religion. So there was not that great a fundamental appeal. You know, the Young Turk Revolution that happened in 1908, there was a modernizing government in power, and a lot of those guys turned out to be kind of power hungry, and we're going to talk about what happened in Turkey during the war. But among these people who were progressive Turks was Mustafa Kemal, that colonel from Gallipoli who would in the future become Ataturk, the founder of his country, and he's the guy who secularized the country. I recommend not the particular war issue, but on Turkey in particular, I recommend this wonderful book by Mustafa Aykal, A-Y-K-O-L, Mustafa Aykal. He's a real simpatico. I saw him at the last Austrian Scholars Conference I was at the Mises Institute. He's a great guy. And the book is Islam Without Extremes. And it's based on this Turkish, and you could even say Ottoman, view of the world. Very interesting. But yeah, I think they were just conscripted. I mean, the government didn't have to worry about now there was propaganda in Turkey. They did have the same kinds of fatuous things going on, but I think the extent was not nearly as great because they could just conscript. Thank you, Cam. Very good. Islam Without Extremes, that's it. Nathan, you've already got it. Excellent. It's sitting there ready to be read. Well, have a good read. He's great. So, what have we here? Any more? I still want the first essay about it tomorrow. Well, Rob, I mean, I'll grade it when I get it. I mean, I know that everybody's got a different schedule and all that, but I would like it by tomorrow. I'll grade a few tomorrow if I can get to them, or Wednesday, but I'll continue to grade them as they come in. I mean, it's not that hard to do, so get to me when you can. And of course, for all of you, that's that's only if you, you know, either want to write an essay or if you want to make sure that you write all the essays and get a grade for the course. So that's the story there. Okay. Have we more questions? Have we more questions? Well, we have a couple of minutes. Is everybody out of questions? I see 23 people on here. Surely there's another question. Can you hear me? Can anybody hear me? Because I'm hearing some odd noises from my computer. Okay, so you can hear me. All right. Okay. Wow, we've never had the questions just end abruptly like that. I hope nothing's happened to you. I hope there hasn't been like an atomic blast. Aha! Thank you, Nathan. And thank you, Leslie. Is there anything to be said of Mises at this time? Yeah, he was in the army, and in fact, in the weeks to come, you will read the whole War Years chapter from Guido Hulsmann's fabulous biography of Mises. It's a fantastic chapter and just fascinating because it's Mises the soldier. Feeling that, you know, on the front end of all this. So, yeah, that's, but he was in the army and artilleryman. It fits. Leslie Webb says, were there any peace feelers sent out in the early years? You know, there were a few ideas. Actually, Wilson, as we'll be looking at in a couple of weeks, Wilson always conceived of himself as somebody who might dabble in the conflict, eventually get in the conflict. And so there were some, you know, he sent Colonel House to Europe to kind of talk to the heads of Europe. And so these were sort of tentative, I suppose you might say, peace feelers. Some church people made suggestions and so forth. But the real peace, the movement for peace, really didn't start until about 1916 or so. And then a number of influential people from different places began to talk about this. Some intellectuals began to write about it and so forth. So, I would say it was a little later, not this early. Kim Ray said, I want your top 10 book recommendations on World War I. Okay, Cam, I'll get them to you pretty soon. You mentioned that before. Harry Verizer says, what's your thought about the book The Rites of Spring? I think you mean the Modris Eckstein's book. That's a book about the ways in which the war had this sort of tribal archetypal urge to it. I like it. It's been a long time since I've read it. I found some of it kind of hard going, some kind of hard to swallow. But in general, I kind of like that book. Eric, and somehow you've got to tell me how to say your name. I think I mispronounced it before. Abravanel. I'm sorry. Anyway, Tragedy and Hope, yeah, he's quickly has some important things to say about this war, especially because he was so well connected to some of the individuals who had done the financial manipulation. This Anglo-American elite, of course, kind of fought the war at its own level, and he was in his in writing this book, it kind of felt like he was kind of a spokesman for these persons. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important book that everybody ought to read. Tommy Newcomb had a great question several months back. he asked, was there any anti-war movement yet? People understood that, and that people that understood the futility of the war. Okay, yeah, Tommy and Erica. Yeah, that is a great question. And there were people from the beginning who didn't buy it. You know, I was going to mention, and just didn't have time to do it, mention the French socialist Jean Jaurès, who was steadfastly against the war. He was assassinated just after the war started in France, the leader of the Socialist Party. A number of intellectuals moved from Germany to Switzerland because they couldn't stand the idea of the war. There were people who resisted in various ways in all countries. The religious resistors resisted from the very beginning. They just wouldn't go to war. And most suffered for it in one way or the other. Of course, in the countries before there's conscription, then there's no compelling reason to punish. But after the Anglo American world adopted conscription, the Anglo world adopted as conscription, then there was plenty of reason to punish. And those pacifists from those kinds of leanings were punished. And of course, the IWW, wherever it existed, the Wobblies, the International Workers of the World, those kind of anarchic socialists, they opposed the war, they were punished. So it comes from a lot of different directions. The intellectuals on high, some politicians. You know, the far left in Germany, the political party of the socialists, the SPD, when on that vote for the war credits, which I was discussing this a little bit this evening, when that vote came, the only party in the Reichstag who refused to vote for the war credits for the war was the left wing of the Socialist Party. And the right wing of the Socialist Party was so patriotic and so pro-war that they kicked the left wing out, and the left wing formed a new party. Actually, the party split in the course of 1914-15 and was then existed for another 4 years as the USPD, the Independent Socialist Party. So they were anti-war too, but of all the political parties, only the left of the socialist left were against that. So yeah, I think that's a great question, and we're going to see other people who said no to war. Erica asks, were there a lot of people who left Europe to move to neutral countries to avoid the war, or just a few intellectuals? I think it was just a few intellectuals. I don't think most people had the means to move. I mean, and once the war started, it was hard to travel. There got to be restrictions on travel, and with the currency inflated and people's money tied up in banks that they couldn't get out of it, slowly being chiseled away and stolen by governments, it was just very hard for just normal people to leave anywhere. And you always ran the risk also of getting into a situation where you go into an enemy country and be picked up as an enemy alien. So there were real dangers associated with travel. Leslie, I don't know about the assassin of, now that you mention it, I don't remember who assassinated Jean Jaurès, but I'll look it up this week. I've just forgotten, I don't know anything about that, or if I did, if I have, I've forgotten. Philip asks another question. What did Ataturk do between the end of the war and when he came to power in 1925? Oh man, that's a big question, because Ataturk, in fact, it's almost too long a question to ask here, but let me just give a very brief answer. This one could go on for a long time. But Ataturk ended the war as Turkey's most successful general, a man of huge influence. He was a person of outstanding abilities. He was one of the great political rhetoricians rhetoricians of the 20th century, he withdrew, retired, and what happened immediately after the war was that that Turkey was surrendered and then was attacked from all sides, French, British occupied Istanbul. The Greeks attacked with a full-fledged attack on Turkey. And in the midst of these of this life and death moment for Turkey, Ataturk came back and helped unify a couple of national meetings of people who were trying to meet to say what to do. And he put himself at the head of a movement to put an army in the field. An interesting thing is that Ataturk made contact with the Rockefellers and got a lot of money against future oil concessions and so forth, and fought a war, financed this war partly in that way against the Greeks, while the Greeks and the Entente were being financed by the Morgan people in London and New York. You get the picture. And the Greeks invaded with great cruelty to the Turkish people, and the Turks pushed them out with great cruelty to the Greeks. And after they were pushed out, the Allies took note. They began to talk to Ataturk and his people, and the treaty that had been imposed, like the Versailles Treaty on Germany, the Treaty of Sèvres, and we'll talk about this at the end, the Treaty of Sèvres imposed on Germany was rewritten by the Allies. It's the only one that was rewritten. And Ataturk successfully negotiated with the Allies and introduced the Treaty of Lausanne. And so Turkey became, it maintained its national territory for the most part, and ended up in good standing with the Allies, and was called by some people the founder of his country, and eventually renamed Ataturk. So that's a short answer. I know that went on a little bit long, but that's a short answer. It's a big question. Eric says, how big a deal was the Lawrence of Arabia development to what you're talking about today? Well, that didn't come until later, but it was again another attempt at sort of breaking the chains through. And I think the revolt in the desert that began in 1917, took place in 1718, was pretty important. And I'm going to talk about that next time. This is part of the imperial kind of aspect of the war, and so I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think it was significant. I mean, I think that it got things moving when the British were a little hesitant to start them moving, and it pushed back, it messed up Turkish supply lines and messed up Turkish ways of attacking the British main front. So I think it was a fairly important kind of thing. Erica says, you've written about the merchants of death. To what extent were the bankers and munitions manufacturers a factor in promoting the war? Well, I think Erica, they were, I don't think there was a simple equation where these people said, well, let's start a war and we'll sell a lot more ammunition, although that's certainly what happened. And please also remember that the armaments companies by the eve of World War I, that all the famous ones had almost all of them been subsumed either in part or in whole by the investment banks or the international banks. And so most of the companies like DuPont that had previously been its own independent company was now controlled by various branches of the Morgan Empire, etc. So, I think that they were interested in getting rich and selling arms, but I think they had a bigger picture in mind as well. And I think one thing that they certainly hoped to do and said that they hoped to do was to produce a different kind of world by means of their intervention and by their manipulation of the currency, by their loaning money to Britain so that Britain could possibly lose and loaning money to Britain's ally France and so forth and so on. So I believe that's a little bit of a vague question because we'd have to go into the details, and I don't think it's as clear as just saying we want to start the war so that we can sell a lot of artillery shells. But that didn't hurt either. And it's also the case that the same companies, as we'll see, the same interests that didn't mind selling shells in the war, or also didn't mind all the destruction because they would help to invest in the rebuilding of that destruction. And I think that's a part of the 20th century and 21st century that we've not gotten rid of. So I think that's an interesting process too. Well, folks, I believe we've done it. It's 8:56, and I think we've answered a lot of questions, and I think we're getting ready for next time. It's an interesting section of the war, this international thing. We're going to start by talking about 1916 and the big battles that took place in that part of the war, then we'll move on and talk about this whole imperial element. And so, very good. Thank you very much. And it's good to see all of you here. I wish we were all in a room together. It would be fun to see you, but very good. Good night, Jeff. Good night, Lee. Good night, Erica and Eric, Russ, Cam. Good night, Savannah. And, yeah, it's great to see you. Oh, Cam, just an